She was speaking with a swift, bright certainty, conscious of nothing but the joy of performing her natural function in her natural world, where nothing could take precedence over the act of offering a solution to a problem. The road will pay for itself within 3 years. I think at a rough glance that the costliest part of the job will be a couple of steel trestles. And there's one spot where I might have to blast a tunnel, but it's only for 100 feet or less. I'll need a steel trestle to throw the track across that gorge and bring it here, but it's not as hard as it looks. Let me show you. Have you got a piece of paper? She did not notice with what speed Galt produced a notebook and a pencil and thrust them into her hands. She seized them, as if she expected them to be there, as if she were giving orders on a construction site, where details of this kind were not to delay her. Let me give you a rough idea of what I mean. If we drive diagonal piles into the rock, she was sketching rapidly, the actual steel span would be only 600 feet long. It would cut off this last half mile of your corkscrew turns. I could have the rail laid in 3 months, and... She stopped. When she looked at their faces, the fire had gone out of hers. She crumpled her sketch and flung it aside into the red dust of the gravel. "Oh, what for?" she cried, the despair breaking out for the first time. "To build 3 miles of railroad and abandon a transcontinental system." The two men were looking at her. She saw no reproach in their faces, only a look of understanding which was almost compassion. "I'm sorry," she said quietly, dropping her eyes. "If you change your mind," said Francisco, "I'll hire you on the spot, or Midas will give you a loan in 5 minutes to finance that railroad if you want to own it yourself." She shook her head. "I can't," she whispered. "Not yet." She raised her eyes, knowing that they knew the nature of her despair, and that it was useless to hide her struggle. "I've tried it once," she said. "I've tried to give it up. I know what it will mean. I'll think of it with every cross tie I'll see laid here, with every spike driven. I'll think of that other tunnel and of Nat Taggart's bridge. Oh, if only I didn't have to hear about it! If only I could stay here and never know what they're doing to the railroad and never learn when it goes." "You'll have to hear about it," said Galt. It was that ruthless tone, peculiarly his, which sounded implacable by being simple, devoid of any emotional value save the quality of respect for facts. "You'll hear the whole course of the last agony of Taggart Transcontinental. You'll hear about every wreck. You'll hear about every discontinued train. You'll hear about every abandoned line. You'll hear about the collapse of the Taggart Bridge. Nobody stays in this valley except by a full conscious choice, based on a full conscious knowledge of every fact involved in his decision. Nobody stays here by faking reality in any manner whatever." She looked at him, her head lifted, knowing what chance he was rejecting. She thought that no man of the outer world would have said this to her at this moment. She thought of the world's code that worshipped white lies as an act of mercy. She felt a stab of revulsion against that code, suddenly seeing its full ugliness for the first time. She felt an enormous pride for the tight, clean face of the man before her. He saw the shape of her mouth drawn firm and self-controlled, yet softened by some tremulous emotion, while she answered quietly, "Thank you. You're right." "You don't have to answer me now," he said. "You'll tell me when you've decided. There's still a week left." "Yes," she said calmly. "Just one more week." He turned, picked up her crumpled sketch, folded it neatly, and slipped it into his pocket. "Dagny," said Francisco, "when you weigh your decision, consider the first time you quit if you wish, but consider everything about it. In this valley you won't have to torture yourself by shingling roofs and building paths that lead nowhere." "Tell me," she asked suddenly, "how did you find out where I was that time?" He smiled. "It was John who told me. The Destroyer, remember? You wondered why the Destroyer had not sent anyone after you? But he had. It was he who sent me there."
"He sent you?"
"Yes."
"What did he say to you?"
"Nothing much. Why?"
"What did he say? Do you remember the exact words?"
"Yes, I do remember. He said, 'If you want your chance, take it. You've earned it.' I remember because..." He turned to Galt with the untroubled frown of a slight casual puzzle. "John, I never quite understood why you said it."
"Why that?"
"Why, my chance."
Do you mind if I don't answer you now?
No, but...
Someone hailed him from the ledges of the mine, and he went off swiftly, as if the subject required no further attention. She was conscious of the long span of moments she took while turning her head to Galt. She knew that she would find him looking at her. She could read nothing in his eyes except a hint of derision, as if he knew what answer she was seeking and that she would not find it in his face.
You gave him a chance that you wanted?
I could have no chance till he'd had every chance possible to him.
How did you know what he had earned?
I'd been questioning him about you for 10 years, every time I could, in every way, from every angle. No, he did not tell me. It was the way he spoke of you that did. He didn't want to speak, but he spoke too eagerly and reluctantly together. And then I knew that it had not been just a childhood friendship. I knew how much he had given up for the strike and how desperately he hadn't given it up forever. I was merely questioning him about one of our most important future strikers, as I questioned him about many others. The hint of derision remained in his eyes. He knew that she had wanted to hear this, but that this was not the answer to the one question she feared. She looked from his face to Francisco's approaching figure, not hiding from herself any longer that her sudden, heavy, desolate anxiety was the fear that Galt might throw the three of them into the hopeless waste of self-sacrifice. Francisco approached, looking at her thoughtfully, as if weighing some question of his own, but some question that gave a sparkle of reckless gaiety to his eyes.
"Dagny, there's only 1 week left," he said. "If you decide to go back, it will be the last for a long time."
There was no reproach and no sadness in his voice, only some softened quality as sole evidence of emotion.
"If you leave now, oh yes, you'll still come back, but it won't be soon. And I, in a few months, I'll come to live here permanently. So if you go, I won't see you again, perhaps for years. I'd like you to spend this last week with me. I'd like you to move to my house, as my guest, nothing else, for no reason. Except that I'd like you to." He said it simply, as if nothing were or could be hidden among the three of them. She saw no sign of astonishment in Galt's face. She felt some swift tightening in her chest, something hard, reckless, and almost vicious that had the quality of a dark excitement driving her blindly into action. "But I'm an employee," she said, with an odd smile, looking at Galt. "I have a job to finish."
"I won't hold you to it," said Galt.
And she felt anger at the tone of his voice, a tone that granted her no hidden significance and answered nothing but the literal meaning of her words.
"You can quit the job any time you wish. It's up to you."
"No, it isn't. I'm a prisoner here, don't you remember? I'm to take orders. I have no preferences to follow, no wishes to express, no decisions to make. I want the decision to be yours."
"You want it to be mine?"
"Yes."
"You've expressed a wish."
The mockery of his voice was in its seriousness, and she threw at him defiantly, not smiling, as if daring him to continue pretending that he did not understand.
"All right, that's what I wish."
He smiled as at a child's complex scheming which he had long since seen through.
"Very well."
But he did not smile as he said, turning to Francisco,
"Then, no."
The defiance toward an adversary who was the sternest of teachers was all that Francisco had read in her face. He shrugged, regretfully but gaily.
"You're probably right. If you can't prevent her from going back, nobody can."
She was not hearing Francisco's words. She was stunned by the magnitude of the relief that hit her at the sound of Galt's answer, a relief that told her the magnitude of the fear it swept away. She knew only after it was over what had hung for her on his decision. She knew that had his answer been different, it would have destroyed the valley in her eyes. She wanted to laugh. She wanted to embrace them both and laugh with them in celebration. It did not seem to matter whether she would stay here or return to the world. A week was like an endless span of time. Either course seemed flooded by an unchanging sunlight. And no struggle was hard, she thought, if this was the nature of existence. The relief did not come from the knowledge that he would not renounce her, nor from any assurance that she would win. The relief came from the certainty that he would always remain what he was.
"I don't know whether I'll go back to the world or not," she said soberly, but her voice was trembling with subdued violence, which was pure gaiety. I'm sorry that I'm still unable to make a decision. I'm certain of only one thing, that I won't be afraid to decide. Francisco took the sudden brightness of her face as proof that the incident had been of no significance, but Galt understood. He glanced at her, and the glance was part amusement, part contemptuous reproach. He said nothing until they were alone, walking down the trail to the valley. Then he glanced at her again, the amusement sharper in his eyes, and said, "You had to put me to a test in order to learn whether I'd fall to the lowest possible stage of altruism?" She did not answer, but looked at him in open, undefensive admission. He chuckled and looked away, and a few steps later said slowly, in the tone of a quotation, "Nobody stays here by faking reality, in any manner whatever." Part of the intensity of her relief, she thought as she walked silently by his side, was the shock of a contrast. She had seen with the sudden, immediate vividness of sensory perception an exact picture of what the code of self-sacrifice would have meant if enacted by the three of them. Galt, giving up the woman he wanted for the sake of his friend, faking his greatest feeling out of existence and himself out of her life, no matter what the cost to him and to her, then dragging the rest of his years through the waste of the unreached and unfulfilled. She turning for consolation to a second choice, faking a love she did not feel, being willing to fake, since her will to self-deceit was the essential required for Galt's self-sacrifice, then living out her years in hopeless longing, accepting as relief for an unhealing wound some moments of weary affection, plus the tenet that love is futile and happiness is not to be found on earth. Francisco struggling in the elusive fog of a counterfeit reality, his life a fraud staged by the two who were dearest to him and most trusted, struggling to grasp what was missing from his happiness, struggling down the brittle scaffold of a lie over the abyss of the discovery that he was not the man she loved, but only a resented substitute, half-charity patient, half-crutch, his perceptiveness becoming his danger, and only his surrender to lethargic stupidity protecting the shoddy structure of his joy, struggling and giving up, and settling into the dreary routine of the conviction that fulfillment is impossible to man. The three of them, who had had all the gifts of existence spread out before them, ending up as embittered hulks, who cry in despair that life is frustration, the frustration of not being able to make unreality real. But this, she thought, was men's moral code in the outer world, a code that told them to act on the premise of one another's weakness, deceit, and stupidity. And this was the pattern of their lives, this struggle through a fog of the pretended and unacknowledged, this belief that facts are not solid or final, this state where denying any form to reality, men stumble through life, unreal and unformed, and die having never been born. Here, she thought, looking down through green branches at the glittering roofs of the valley, one dealt with men as clear and firm as sun and rocks, and the immense lightheartedness of her relief came from the knowledge that no battle was hard, no decision was dangerous, where there was no soggy uncertainty, no shapeless evasion to encounter. "Did it ever occur to you, Miss Taggart," said Galt in the casual tone of an abstract discussion, but as if he had known her thoughts, "that there is no conflict of interests among men, neither in business nor in trade, nor in their most personal desires, if they omit the irrational from their view of the possible, and destruction from their view of the practical? There is no conflict, and no call for sacrifice, and no man is a threat to the aims of another, if men understand that reality is an absolute not to be faked, that lies do not work, that the unearned cannot be had, that the undeserved cannot be given, that the destruction of a value which is will not bring value to that which isn't. The businessman who wishes to gain a market by throttling a superior competitor, the worker who wants a share of his employer's wealth, the artist who envies a rival's higher talent, they're all wishing facts out of existence, and destruction is the only means of their wish. If they pursue it, they will not achieve a market, a fortune, or an immortal fame. They will merely destroy production, employment, and art. A wish for the irrational is not to be achieved, whether the sacrificial victims are willing or not. But men will not cease to desire the impossible, and will not lose their longing to destroy, so long as self-destruction and self-sacrifice are preached to them as the practical means of achieving the happiness of the recipients. He glanced at her and added slowly, a slight emphasis as soul change in the impersonal tone of his voice. No one's happiness but my own is in my power to achieve or to destroy. You should have had more respect for him and for me than to fear what you had feared. She did not answer. She felt as if a word would overfill the fullness of this moment. She merely turned to him with a look of acquiescence that was disarmed, childishly humble, and would have been an apology, but for its shining joy. He smiled in amusement, in understanding, almost in comradeship of the things they shared, and in sanction of the things she felt. They went on in silence, and it seemed to her that this was a summer day out of a carefree youth she had never lived. It was just a walk through the country by two people who were free for the pleasure of motion and sunlight, with no unsolved burdens left to carry. Her sense of lightness blended with the weightless sense of walking downhill, as if she needed no effort to walk, only to restrain herself from flying. And she walked, fighting the speed of the downward pull, her body leaning back, the wind blowing her skirt like a sail to break her motion. They parted at the bottom of the trail. He went to keep an appointment with Midas Mulligan, while she went to Hammond's Market with a list of items for the evening's dinner as the sole concern of her world. His wife, she thought, letting herself hear consciously the word Dr. Axton had not pronounced, the word she had long since felt but never named. For 3 weeks, she had been his wife, in every sense but one, and that final one was still to be earned. But this much was real, and today she could permit herself to know it, to feel it, to live with that one thought for this one day. The groceries, which Lawrence Hammond was lining up at her order, on the polished counter of his store, had never appeared to her as such shining objects, and intent upon them, she was only half conscious of some disturbing element, of something that was wrong, but that her mind was too full to notice. She noticed it only when she saw Hammond pause, frown, and stare upward, at the sky beyond his open storefront. In time with his words, "I think somebody's trying to repeat your stunt, Miss Taggart." She realized that it was the sound of an airplane overhead, and that it had been there for some time, a sound which was not to be heard in the valley after the first of this month. They rushed out to the street. The small silver cross of a plane was circling above the ring of mountains, like a sparkling dragonfly about to brush the peaks with its wings. "What does he think he's doing?" said Lawrence Hammond. There were people at the doors of the shops and standing still all down the street looking up. Is anyone expected?" she asked, and was astonished by the anxiety of her own voice. "No," said Hammond. "Everyone who's got any business here is here." He did not sound disturbed, but grimly curious. The plane was now a small dash, like a silver cigarette streaking against the flanks of the mountains. It had dropped lower. "Looks like a private monoplane," said Hammond, squinting against the sun. "Not an army model." "Will the ray screen hold out?" she asked tensely, in a tone of defensive resentment against the approach of an enemy. He chuckled. "Hold out? Will he see us?" "That screen is safer than an underground vault, Miss Taggart, as you ought to know." The plane rose, and for a moment it was only a bright speck like a bit of paper blown by the wind. It hovered uncertainly, then dropped down again into another circling spiral. "What in hell is he after?" said Hammond. Her eyes shot suddenly to his face. "He's looking for something," said Hammond. "What?" "Is there a telescope somewhere?"
"Why, yes, at the airfield, but—"
He was about to ask what was the matter with her voice, but she was running across the road down the path to the airfield, not knowing that she was running, driven by a reason she had no time and no courage to name. She found Dwight Sanders at the small telescope of the control tower. He was watching the plane attentively with a puzzled frown. "Let me see it," she snapped. She clutched the metal tube. She pressed her eye to the lens, her hand guiding the tube slowly to follow the plane. Then he saw that her hand had stopped, but her fingers did not open,
and her face remained bent over the telescope pressed to the lens, until he looked closer and saw that the lens was pressed to her forehead.
"What's the matter, Miss Taggart?"
She raised her head slowly.
"Is it anyone you know, Miss Taggart?"
She did not answer. She hurried away, her steps rushing with the zigzagging aimlessness of uncertainty. She dared not run, but she had to escape, she had to hide. She did not know whether she was afraid to be seen by the men around her or by the plane above, the plane whose silver wings bore the number that belonged to Hank Reardon. She stopped when she stumbled over a rock and fell, and noticed that she had been running. She was on a small ledge in the cliffs above the airfield, hidden from the sight of the town, open to the view of the sky. She rose, her hands groping for support along a granite wall, feeling the warmth of the sun on the rock under her palms. She stood, her back pressed to the wall, unable to move or to take her eyes off the plane. The plane was circling slowly, dipping down, then rising again, struggling, she thought, as she had struggled, to distinguish the sight of a wreck in a hopeless spread of crevices and boulders, an elusive spread neither clear enough to abandon nor to survey. He was searching for the wreck of her plane. He had not given up. And whatever the 3 weeks of it had cost him, whatever he felt, the only evidence he would give to the world and his only answer was this steady, insistent, monotonous drone of a motor carrying a fragile craft over every deadly foot of an inaccessible chain of mountains. Through the brilliant purity of the summer air, the plane seemed intimately close. She could see it rock on precarious currents and bank under the thrusts of wind. She could see, and it seemed impossible that so clear a sight was closed to his eyes. The whole of the valley lay below him, flooded by sunlight, flaming with glass panes and green lawns, screaming to be seen. The end of his tortured quest, the fulfillment of more than his wishes, not the wreck of her plane and her body, but her living presence and his freedom. All that he was seeking or had ever sought was now spread open before him, open and waiting, his to be reached by a straight-line dive through the pure, clear air, his, and asking nothing of him but the capacity to see. "Hank!" she screamed, waving her arms in desperate signal. "Hank!" She fell back against the rock, knowing that she had no way to reach him, that she had no power to give him sight, that no power on earth could pierce that screen, except his own mind and vision. Suddenly, and for the first time, she felt the screen, not as the most intangible, but as the most grimly absolute barrier in the world. Slumped against the rock, she watched in silent resignation the hopeless circles of the plane's struggle, and its motor's uncomplaining cry for help, a cry she had no way to answer. The plane swooped down abruptly, but it was only the start of its final rise. It cut a swift diagonal across the mountains and shot into the open sky. Then, as if caught in the spread of a lake with no shores and no exit, it went sinking slowly and drowning out of sight. She thought in bitter compassion of how much he had failed to see. "And I?" she thought. If she left the valley, the screen would close for her as tightly. Atlantis would descend under a vault of rays more impregnable than the bottom of the ocean, and she too would be left to struggle for the things she had not known how to see. She too would be left to fight a mirage of primordial savagery, while the reality of all that she desired would never come again within her reach. But the pull of the outer world, the pull that drew her to follow the plane, was not the image of Hank Reardon. She knew that she could not return to him, even if she returned to the world. The pull was the vision of Hank Reardon's courage, and the courage of all those still fighting to stay alive. He would not give up the search for her plane, when all others had long since despaired, as he would not give up his mills, as he would not give up any goal he had chosen if a single chance was left. Was she certain that no chance remained for the world of Taggart Transcontinental? Was she certain that the terms of the battle were such that she could not care to win? They were right, the men of Atlantis. They were right to vanish if they knew that they left no value behind them. But until and unless she saw that no chance was untaken and no battle unfought, she had no right to remain among them. This was the question that had lashed her for weeks, but had not driven her to a glimpse of the answer. She lay awake through the hours of that night, quietly motionless, following like an engineer, and like Hank Reardon, a process of dispassionate, precise, almost mathematical consideration, with no regard for cost or feeling. The agony which he lived in his plane, she lived it in a soundless cube of darkness, searching but finding no answer. She looked at the inscriptions on the walls of her room, faintly visible in patches of starlight, but the help those men had called in their darkest hour was not hers to call. Yes or no, Miss Taggart? She looked at the faces of the four men in the soft twilight of Mulligan's living room. Galt, whose face had the serene, impersonal attentiveness of a scientist. Francisco, whose face was made expressionless by the hint of a smile, the kind of smile that would fit either answer. Hugh Axton, who looked compassionately gentle. Midas Mulligan, who had asked the question with no touch of rancor in his voice. Somewhere, 2,000 miles away, at this sunset hour, the page of a calendar was springing into light over the roofs of New York, saying, June 28th. And it seemed to her suddenly that she was seeing it, as if it were hanging over the heads of these men. I have one more day, she said steadily. Will you let me have it? I think I've reached my decision, but I'm not fully certain of it, and I'll need all the certainty possible to me.
Of course, said Mulligan. You have, in fact, until morning of the day after tomorrow. We'll wait.
We'll wait after that as well, said Hugh Axton, though in your absence, if that be necessary. She stood by the window facing them, and she felt a moment's satisfaction in the knowledge that she stood straight, that her hands did not tremble, that her voice sounded as controlled, uncomplaining, and unpitying as theirs. It gave her a moment's feeling of a bond to them.
If any part of your uncertainty, said Galt, is a conflict between your heart and your mind, follow your mind.
Consider the reasons which make us certain that we are right, said Hugh Axton, but not the fact that we are certain. If you are not convinced, ignore our certainty. Don't be tempted to substitute our judgment for your own.
Don't rely on our knowledge of what's best for your future, said Mulligan. We do know. But it can't be best until you know it. Don't consider our interests or desires, said Francisco. You have no duty to anyone but yourself.
She smiled neither sadly nor gaily, thinking that none of it was the sort of advice she would have been given in the outer world, and knowing how desperately they wished to help her where no help was possible, she felt it was her part to give them reassurance. I forced my way here, she said quietly. And I was to bear responsibility for the consequences. I'm bearing it. Her reward was to see Galt smile. The smile was like a military decoration bestowed upon her. Looking away, she remembered suddenly Jeff Allen, the tramp aboard the Comet, in the moment when she had admired him for attempting to tell her that he knew where he was going, to spare her the burden of his aimlessness. She smiled faintly, thinking that she had now experienced it in both roles, and knew that no action could be lower or more futile than for one person to throw upon another the burden of his abdication of choice. She felt an odd calm, almost a confident repose. She knew that it was tension, but the tension of a great clarity. She caught herself thinking, she's functioning well in an emergency. I'll be all right with her. And realized that she was thinking of herself.
Let it go till day after tomorrow, Miss Taggart, said Midas Mulligan. Tonight, you're still here.
Thank you, she said. She remained by the window while they went on discussing the valley's business. It was their closing conference of the month. They had just finished dinner, and she thought of her first dinner in this house a month ago. She was wearing, as she had then worn, the gray suit that belonged in her office, not the peasant skirt that had been so easy to wear in the sun. I'm still here tonight, she thought, her hand pressed possessively to the window sill. The sun had not yet vanished beyond the mountains,
but the sky was an even, deep, deceptively clear blue that blended with the blue of invisible clouds into a single spread hiding the sun. Only the edges of the clouds were outlined by a thin thread of flame, and it looked like a glowing, twisted net of neon tubing, she thought, like a chart of winding rivers, like